Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Picture this. You are in a courtroom where the defense attorney is literally pounding his fist on the lectern, screaming about prosecutorial misconduct because someone dared to mention that no dog DNA was found on the victim's clothing. Well, that's kind of the reason. This is the same defense team that wants you to believe a Boston police officer was allegedly mauled to death by a German Shepherd named Chloe in someone's basement, then dragged outside and planted in a snowbank. But at that time, there was no snowbank, so just out in the middle of their yard. To frame their client. Welcome to June 3rd in the Karen Reed trial, where the defense's desperation has reached levels that would make a reality TV show producer maybe blush a little bit. Welcome. Want to hear your thoughts in the comments if you're watching us on YouTube or X. And if you're listening to the podcast, be sure to check us out over there so you can conversate with us and we can hear your opinions as well. Hit subscribe, everybody, wherever you're watching to, whether it's YouTube, X, if it's wherever podcast platform you're listening on, Apple, Spotify, wherever you may be, we're everywhere. Do hit subscribe so you don't miss any of our coverage of the case. All right, let's get down to it. If you've been following this Massachusetts murder case, you know that it started as a fairly straightforward drunk driving homicide case and has now somehow morphed into what can only be described as a legal fever dream involving canine conspiracies and evidence tampering theories that would make QAnon theorists say, now, hold on, that seems a little far-fetched. But yesterday's courtroom proceedings revealed just how catastrophically the defense strategy is backfiring, with their star expert witness getting systematically destroyed on cross-examination, while their legal team resorted to demanding mistrials every time inconvenient facts seemed to surface. Let's start with Dr. Marie Russell, the defense's so-called dog bite expert from Los Angeles, whose testimony was supposed to be the cornerstone of their alternative theory Russell's credentials for this specific type of analysis are about as impressive as my qualifications to perform neurosurgery after watching a few medical documentaries on YouTube. She admitted under oath that she's never testified as a dog bite expert before this case, and that there are no established professional standards for determining dog bite patterns from photographs. Her methodology relies on something she calls differential diagnosis and pattern recognition, which in scientific terms translates to, I look at it and here's what I think. Okay. But here's where it gets truly absurd. Russell didn't just stumble into this case through normal expert witness channels. She actually reached out to the defense team after reading about the case in the Boston Globe, essentially volunteering her services like an amateur detective inserting themselves into a police investigation. This isn't an objective expert sought out for recognized expertise. This is someone who decided she wanted to be part of a high-profile case and convinced the defense to let her play expert witness. And they're like, okay, well, no one else seems to want to do it, so you seem nice. Maybe? She bought me a coffee early. I digress. The prosecution, led by Hank Brennan, methodically exposed the fundamental weaknesses of Russell's entire approach. She's making definitive pronouncements about wound patterns based on looking at photographs on a computer screen from 3,000 miles away with no peer-reviewed methodology to support her conclusions. It's like having someone examine a picture of a car accident and confidently declare it was caused by alien intervention rather than driver error, based purely on their personal interpretation of alien intervention and damage patterns. What makes Russell's testimony particularly devastating for the defense is how it highlights the pseudoscientific foundation of their entire alternative theory. When pressed by Brennan, she couldn't point to any professional organization that would certify her conclusions or any published studies supporting her specific analytical methods. She acknowledged that another expert, Armed Forces Deputy Medical Examiner John C. Walsh, had concluded the wounds were highly unlikely to have come from an animal bite, but she simply dismissed this opinion from someone with presumably far more experience analyzing traumatic injuries. Then came the moment that triggered the defense's complete meltdown. Brennan asked Russell if she was aware that O'Keefe's clothing had been swabbed for dog DNA. This is absolutely relevant evidence if the defense's theory is that O'Keefe was killed by a dog attack, or at least part of this death with a dog attack. Yet apparently mentioning this fact sent the defense team into hysterics, like someone had violated some sacred courtroom taboo. Robert Alessi's explosive reaction was truly something to behold. He demanded a mistrial with prejudice, arguing that Brennan had deliberately introduced prejudicial evidence that the prosecution had chosen not to present through their own witness. The legal logic here is breathtaking in its audacity. The defense wants the jury to believe O'Keefe was killed by a dog while simultaneously arguing that any mention of the absence of dog DNA should be forbidden from discussion. It's like claiming someone was attacked by a bear while insisting that nobody should be allowed to mention the complete lack of bear fur, bear saliva, or bear DNA at the scene. Judge Beverly Cannone, demonstrating the patience of Job, denied the mistrial motion after a 30-minute recess. Her brief response preserved the defense's right for appeal while making it clear she wasn't going to throw out the trial because they didn't like having their theory challenged by actual evidence. When testimony resumed, Russell faced the impossible task of explaining why no canine DNA was found on O'Keefe's clothing despite her confident assertions about a violent dog attack. Her explanations became increasingly strained, so to speak, suggesting that evidence could have been contaminated because the clothing had been on an emergency room floor. This explanation requires believing that a vicious dog attack somehow occurred with such surgical precision that it left no detectable DNA evidence, no fur, nothing, which stretches credibility beyond any, I think, reasonable limit. The cross-examination revealed other problematic aspects of Russell's involvement. She admitted meeting with the defense attorneys multiple times and reviewing extensive case materials, raising some questions about whether her opinions were influenced by the defense team's preferred narrative rather than objective scientific analysis. Her willingness to dismiss contrary expert opinions while maintaining her own conclusions, despite the absence of supporting DNA evidence, suggests someone more interested in advocacy than objective medical assessments, maybe. After lunch, the defense called Sergeant Nicholas Barros from the Dighton Police, apparently hoping he would then provide ammunition for their evidence tampering conspiracy theory. Barros testified about observing allegedly less severe taillight damage when Reed's SUV was initially towed compared to later photographs taken at Canton Police Department. However, this testimony created more problems than solutions for the defense. Barros' documentation of this supposedly crucial evidence consists of exactly one line in his incident report. The vehicle had damage to the right rear taillight. For someone whose testimony is supposedly critical to proving and providing evidence was tampered with, his documentation is remarkably sparse. When questioned by Brennan about this brevity, Barros explained his role was primarily traffic control during the tow, essentially admitting that he wasn't focused on detailed evidence preservation. The prosecution effectively highlighted that Barros has been exposed to extensive media coverage of this high-profile case over the past 3 years. His acknowledgement that he doesn't live under a rock and that coverage is all over social media and the news raises serious questions about whether his current recollections have been influenced by information absorbed since the original incident. Human memory is notoriously malleable under ideal circumstances, but when someone has been marinating in media coverage of an event for years, their memories become increasingly unreliable. Brennan also revealed that Barros had met with defense attorneys at a Boston hotel since his first trial testimony, though Barros claimed he didn't find this unusual. This additional contact between witnesses and the defense team, combined with the media exposure, further undermines the reliability of his current recollections compared to his sparse contemporaneous notes. The defense showed videos from the tow date that the claimed supported Barros's, rather that they claim supported Barros's recollection, but the video quality makes definitive assessment of damage extent pretty much impossible. The prosecution maintained that the videos actually showed significant damage was already present, and honestly, arguing over grainy footage kind of feels like having art critics debate an emotional content of an abstract painting. What's particularly striking about the day's proceedings is how they expose the fundamental weaknesses of the defense's entire approach. Their alternative theory requires believing in an elaborate conspiracy involving multiple law enforcement officers, civilian witnesses, homeowners, all coordinated with precision that would challenge professional intelligence agencies. According to this narrative, O'Keefe was allegedly lured into the Elbert house, attacked by a dog that somehow avoided leaving any DNA evidence, then carried outside and positioned to make it appear he was struck by a vehicle. Consider the logistics that theory demands. Multiple people would have had to coordinate the cover-up while intoxicated at a house party, successfully fool multiple investigators, manipulate physical evidence without detection, and maintain absolute silence about their involvement for years. While the case received massive media attention, the complexity required makes Ocean's 11 look a lot like a documentary about realistic heist planning. Meanwhile, the prosecution's case presents a straightforward narrative, supported by a physical evidence, witness testimony, and Reed's own statements. She was heavily intoxicated. She and O'Keefe had been arguing. She was observed driving erratically. And she made incriminating statements afterwards, including, "Did I hit him?" before anyone told her O'Keefe had been struck by a vehicle. It's like finding someone standing over a body holding a smoking gun while asking, Did I shoot him? But then having their claim that they were framed by an elaborate conspiracy. The defense's legal tactics have become increasingly desperate as their case deteriorates. This marks the second time they've demanded a mistrial with prejudice, essentially asking the judge to end the trial because they don't like how the evidence is developing. In legal terms, this is like rage quitting a video game every time you start losing, except with considerably higher stakes and professional consequences. Their expert witness selection has proven particularly disastrous. Russell was supposed to provide scientific credibility to their dog attack theory, but instead, her testimony revealed the pseudoscientific foundation of their entire alternative narrative. Having an expert who admits she lacks established methodology, peer review, or professional standards while dismissing contrary expert opinions essentially destroys any claim to scientific validity. The prosecution has systematically demonstrated that the defense's theories collapse under basic scrutiny. Their dog attack narrative requires believing that a violent animal assault occurred without leaving any DNA evidence. Their evidence tampering claims rest on the unreliable memory of an officer whose documentation was minimal, and their expert witness essentially admitted she invented her analytical approach herself. What's particularly damaging is how the defense's own witnesses keep undermining their theories. Russell's acknowledgement that no dog DNA was found directly contradicts her confident assertions about animal attacks. Barrow's sparse documentation and media exposure undermine his credibility as a witness to alleged evidence tampering. Each witness called to support the defense narrative instead highlights its fundamental implausibility. The courtroom atmosphere yesterday in this trial, it's been thick with the kind of tension that develops when someone's bluff is being systematically called. And they're running out of cards to play. Karen Reed sat at the defense table as her legal team strategy unraveled in real time, with each objection and mistrial demand revealing their increasing panic as reality intruded on their carefully constructive alternative narrative. The contrast between prosecution and defense approaches couldn't have been more stark. While Brennan methodically dismantled witness credibility through careful questioning and attention to evidence, the defense resorted to theatrical outrage and procedural objections whenever facts threatened their preferred storyline. Professional courtroom observers have noted how the defense's constant interruptions and demands for mistrial suggests a team that has lost control of the narrative. From a strategic perspective, today's proceedings essentially destroyed the defense's credibility with potential jurors. When your primary expert admits she lacks qualifications and methodology, while your conspiracy theory requires believing multiple people coordinated an elaborate cover-up without leaving evidence, you move beyond reasonable doubt into fantasy territory. The prosecution has successfully established that Reed was intoxicated, fighting with O'Keefe, driving erratically, made incriminating statements afterwards. The defense's alternative theories require extraordinary leaps of logic and suspension of disbelief that few rational jurors are likely to make. Physical evidence, witness testimony, and basic common sense all point toward a drunk driving homicide rather than an elaborate framework involving killer dogs and evidence tampering. The legal implications extend beyond this specific case. Russell's testimony highlights the dangers of allowing unqualified experts to testify based on invented methodologies, while the defense's tactical choices demonstrate how conspiracy theories can undermine legitimate legal advocacy. Courts depend on reliable expert testimony and good faith legal arguments, both of which were notably absent from the defense's presentation. As this retrial continues with Wednesday's half-day session, the defense faces the nearly impossible task of recovering from what can only be described as a catastrophic day. They've established that their expert can't provide reliable scientific opinions. Their evidence tampering theory relies on speculation and contaminated memories. And their legal strategy consists primarily of demanding do-overs whenever reality conflicts with their narrative. The prosecution has successfully exposed the defense's alternative theories as elaborate fiction while maintaining focus on the actual evidence. With each passing day, the case increasingly resembles someone trying to convince a jury that up is down, black is white, while actual evidence continues pointing towards the obvious conclusion. At this point, the defense would need intervention from a higher power to convince reasonable people that Karen Reed is the victim of an elaborate conspiracy rather than someone who allegedly killed her boyfriend while driving drunk and is now desperately trying to avoid responsibility for her actions. What are your thoughts, everyone? Tell me in the comments section. And be sure to press subscribe if you're watching us on YouTube.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Karen Reed.
Day 25 of the trial of Karen Reed. And we've learned one thing. If there's one thing that is for sure in this trial, it's that nothing can just be straightforward. There can't just be a, here's what I saw. No, it's a false memory. Okay, I mean, those things do happen. But does it have to happen on this one right here? Because it's kind of an important one. And I get the timeline lined up later, and it didn't turn out to be that you could even physically be there. But in a case that is fraught with conspiracy theory, this just adds more to it. Is it the blue line that is being protected here right now? Because I'm going to be honest, it feels a little off. Now, could there be some protection going on here just to protect some people? Not necessarily to say that the conspiracy is all real, because I just don't think that's physically possible or mentally possible with this many people and this many cluster-like people. But I think the two can coexist. And look, I've said it from the beginning. Yeah, the investigation, a lot of screw-ups there, a lot of problems. There's been some that I've looked at and gone, okay, I can understand them in a different light now, under some context. And there's still some that are just really weird. And this one's kind of weird. I'm going to be honest with you. But again, two things can coexist at once. There can be some kind of, you know, let's cover for people so they don't get in trouble, even if they weren't doing anything, just to not bring that into this mess. I could see that type of thinking. I could see a lot of types of thinking here. And that's the important thing, to be open to different ways of thinking about this. Could there be something of, you know, we need you to kind of toe the line here, because, I don't know, maybe there's things that this officer isn't even aware about that could be looked into that they don't want a bigger microscope on. I don't know the answer to that question. And I'm not sitting here saying that there's a conspiracy, because I don't believe there is. But I'm sorry, it's a little weird. It's a little weird not to know those things. I think she came across as a credible witness, though. And she had one hell of a personality. And if it wasn't for that personality and the conjecture that she brought to this case, they could have really run with her. But unfortunately, at the end of the day, even though there is this looks a little weird problem going on here, she won. She really, really stuck it to them. When you have the witness riffing that, yeah, and then I called the FBI on something the defense, after you accused the defense attorneys of trying to get you to make things up on the stand, which I really kind of, I believe that part. I believe that there was certainly, they were not very happy with the fact that she came back and said that that had to be a false memory because I couldn't have physically been there by the timeline. I could see you being a little upset if you're on the defense, and this was a witness that was really going to deliver some of an impending blow that you really were expecting to be there, and then it falls completely flat. I don't know why you brought her up, considering she already told you she wasn't going to testify that way. Now, that's a little bit more on you, Mr. Jackson. I'm sorry, Mr. Jackson. Woo, this witness stunk. She did not work for you at all. Okay, I'm going to stop doing that. I don't know. I think a big misstep by the defense. I think they very much underestimated what they were going to get. I think they thought they could navigate it any way that she was going to take it, but I don't think they anticipated this young woman who is seemingly take no shit and really can bring it when needed. It was like a badass Daria against Alan Jackson. Anyway, depending on the side you're looking at this on, I'm trying to look in the middle of this. But if you're stuck on one side or the other, you're going to think it was a slam dunk for either side. And again, depending on where you're looking at it, I can kind of see both. But I still don't think there's a conspiracy going on. And the evidence to me has already proven that Karen Reed had struck John O'Keefe with her vehicle. No questions about it. Motive, did she know it? All that, that's still, I think, a little bit up in the air. For me, not so much. But I do think it is up in the air for a jury right now. At least that's the way I'm reading it. Tell me in the comments what you think about how the day went. I do think she was damning. But that was a hot potato for a few moments there. Could have gone either way. It's a kind of moment in a courtroom that makes everyone stop shifting in their seats. Former Canton police officer Kelly Deaver. I don't want to insult you, Kelly, because I know that was a good move today, by the way. You don't remember my name. That touche. That was lovely. I'm going to go with Dever. I apologize. I can't remember anyone's name, even when repeated in front of me, clearly 5, 6, 7 times today while watching the testimony. Sitting under oath, she looked straight across the room and told the jury something that hit like a thunderclap. The defense, Karen Reed's own legal team, had allegedly pressured her to lie on the stand. Not only that, but when she refused, she said they threatened to charge her with perjury. And just imagine that for a second. And put yourself in her shoes. A defense team trying to dismantle a murder case by alleging a vast conspiracy of cover-ups, now standing accused by their own witness of doing the very thing they said the cops did. Trying to control the story, trying to bend the facts, trying to win no matter what the truth. Let's back up and walk through how we got here. June 2nd, day 25. Of the Karen Reed trial, no motions, no procedural distractions, just testimony. And from the moment court opened, the defense seemed ready to go on the offensive. They had a card to play, a set of private group chat messages from former Massachusetts State Trooper Michael Proctor, the original lead investigator on the case, messages that on paper looked like the kind of thing you build a misconduct motion around. Vulgar, personal, inappropriate, and maybe, just maybe, the defense hoped enough to convince a jury that the whole case was poisoned from the start by bias and unprofessionalism. The court had already ruled that Proctor didn't have to testify for the messages to be admitted. Instead, they brought in Jonathan Diamonds, a popular DJ at the local strip. No, I'm kidding. No. Jonathan Diamonds here tonight. And here comes Lexi. Anyway. I'm sorry. He seemed like a nice guy. A childhood friend of Proctor's. He took the stand with the sole purpose of authenticating the texts. He confirmed that, yes, Proctor had written them. Yes, they were crude. Yes, they showed disdain for Karen Reed. And yes, they made a lot of people in that courtroom squirm in their seats. But there's one problem. For all the foul language, the texts didn't say what the defense probably wished they did. There was no mention of planting evidence, no instructions to falsify reports, no admission of a cover-up, just personal disgust and, frankly, immaturity. Prosecutor Hank Brennan saw the opening and took it. During cross-examination, he made sure that the jury heard every nasty word, then asked Diamonds the real questions. Had Proctor ever said he tampered with evidence? No. Had he ever talked about framing Reed? No. Was there any conversation in that chat about manufacturing charges or hiding the truth? Again, no. What was left was a portrait of a bitter man with a trash mouth and poor judgment. Potty mouth, as some of us parents say sometimes. I don't think I've ever used that term. And my child swears like a sailor, so, but not necessarily a corrupt cop. It was a bad look, sure, but it didn't prove the defense's central theory that Karen Reed was the victim of a law enforcement conspiracy. Did not. And it sure as hell did not land any way like it did during the first trial. Now, that alone would have been enough to call it a day and a rough one for the defense. But it was what happened next that turned rough into disastrous. Enter Kelly Dever. Dever is no stranger to this case. She was working on the night O'Keefe was found in that snowbank. She had been interviewed by federal agents in the past and even made statements that seemed to support part of the defense's theory that there was something unusual about how Reed's SUV ended up in the Canton police garage, specifically the Sallyport, that she had seen Chief Ken Berkowitz and Officer Brian Higgins alone with the SUV for a wildly long time. Her quote, "When she took the stand today, she was not the witness the defense expected or needed her to be." Dever walked in and more or less opened with this, "I don't know why I'm here." She told the court she had no useful testimony to give. When questioned about her previous statement, she admitted, yes, she had told federal agents she thought she saw Berkowitz and Higgins alone with the car. But she later learned she couldn't have seen it. She had already left the station before the SUV arrived. The timeline proved it. As far as she was concerned, that memory, it wasn't real. It was a false memory. She called it distorted, a false memory influenced by media coverage and speculation that she'd seen online. A flawed recollection, not a smoking gun. But that wasn't the headline. The headline was what she said next. Dever claimed that prior to this first trial, the defense team had contacted her during that conversation. She said a male member of Reed's legal team, not named in open court, told her what they wanted her to say. That she had seen Higgins and Berkowitz in the garage. That she should testify to that. And when she told them she couldn't say that because it wasn't true, they allegedly got aggressive, raised their voices, and dropped the P word. Not P Diddy. Perjury. Then, in open court, under oath, she looked at Alan Jackson and said, "You threatened to charge me with perjury if I didn't lie on the stand." It got really quiet for a moment. If I had a cricket sound effect, I might consider using it, even though I hate sound effects. That moment alone, right there, it changed the energy in the room. You could feel it. Suddenly, the defense's playbook wasn't just under scrutiny, it was on trial itself. The defense, who had built their case around the idea that the system was bullying Karen Reed, was now being accused of bullying a witness. It's important to be clear here. Jackson denied it. The defense team objected immediately. The judge sustained no further elaboration, but the statement was made, it was heard, and the jury saw it happen in real time. What followed was a tense exchange between Dever and Jackson. He pushed her on her earlier words. She pushed back. He reminded her she'd told him her memory was distorted and that she expected to be torn apart on the stand. She responded, That's what you're trying to do. At one point, Jackson quoted her directly using language she said she couldn't recall. She accused him of twisting her words, he kept going, and it was put lightly, and it was very uncomfortable to watch, quite honestly. It kept going, and it got heated. Then came the prosecution's cleanup. Hank Brennan, calm and surgical, addressed the elephant in the room. Was Deaver's testimony the result of pressure from the blue wall? Was she trying to protect fellow officers? Never said no. Brennan asked about her meeting with Boston Police Commissioner Michael Cox. She said Cox explicitly told her not to talk about the case, that he only said she had the department's support and that she should do what was right. No orders, no cover-up, no coaching, just be honest. If the defense had hoped to show that Dever flipped because of pressure from police brass, I don't think they really landed it very well. What the jury heard instead was a woman who corrected herself when the facts told her she was wrong, and who, when asked to lie to make the defense's story fit, refused. By the time court broke for lunch, the entire energy around the case had shifted. A day that began with the defense attempting to put law enforcement on trial ended with their own witnesses peeling back the curtain on a strategy that seemed less about truth and more about theater, which I think the jury has already seen quite a bit of, and I think they might be getting a little sick of it. Might be reading into what's going on here. Overplaying your hand a bit there. And just like that, the courtroom was no longer focused on whether Karen Reed hit John O'Keefe with her SUV, but on whether her defense team was willing to hit back at reality hard enough to break it. The courtroom shifted tone in the afternoon after a tense, dramatic morning filled with direct accusations, emotional fallout, and a defense team on the defensive. The spotlight moved to something colder, more clinical. This was the defense's reset button, their scientific swing, their alternate theory on how Boston police officer John O'Keefe died. They brought in Dr. Marie Russell. The jury had already heard the suggestion before that O'Keefe wasn't struck by Karen Reed's Lexus, but rather attacked by a dog, a big dog, the kind of dog that could live in the Albert family's Canton home, but didn't have a lower jaw, no saliva or DNA. And Willie was bad at biting because he couldn't puncture skin. You know, that kind of dog. Yeah, they didn't have that kind of dog. But this was the day the theory got its day in court. Again, and it came wrapped in credentials, Russell introduced herself as a double-boarded emergency medicine physician and forensic pathologist with a background that included time in MIT, UMass Medical, and experience with hundreds of trauma patients. She'd seen car crashes, she'd seen dog bites, and she told the jury she believed the injuries on John O'Keefe sustained, that John O'Keefe sustained, were more consistent with the latter. Despite not having knowledge that the injuries did not puncture the skin. When she found that out, well, that still didn't change anything, because you don't want to be wrong. Her direct examination began with a quiet confidence. Russell explained that her prior work with police canine units, her familiarity with bite and hold injury patterns, and the number of dog bites cases that she treated, she estimated over 500 in her career. Seems a bit inflated if you look at the actual numbers of dog bites in the United States in a year. Well, let's just say she's doing a lot of them if her numbers are right. Wasn't a flimsy resume, at least it sure didn't look like one. And the defense made sure the jury knew that. This was someone who knew trauma, knew wounds, and had read the medical examiner's report and reviewed the autopsy photos. Then came her certain claim, her central claim. Russell testified that in her expert opinion, John O'Keefe's injuries, specifically to his arms, were inconsistent with being struck by a vehicle. In fact, she said they were more likely the result of a dog attack. She pointed to defensive wounds, patterns of tearing, although there was no tearing, and the specific locations of the injuries. The arms, she said, are often where people suffer bites when trying to shield themselves. She emphasized that O'Keefe's legs, the most common point of impact in pedestrian vehicle collisions, were notably uninjured. It was compelling as a visual. Keep in mind, she never was there at the autopsy. She's looking at a kind of shitty photo. And for a moment, it gave shape to the defense's longstanding argument that something far more violent and human happened inside that house on Fairview Road. Russell testified that based on the pattern of injuries, puncture-like wounds, and the absence of abrasions typically seen with vehicle strikes, although the vehicle expert kind of debunked that already, O'Keefe may have been attacked, possibly by a large dog. Again, that doesn't impact your skin, just makes very light abrasions and no incisions, and doesn't have a bottom jaw. The implication, though, never stated outright, was very clear. Karen Reed's vehicle was not what killed him, is what she was trying to get to. Then came the cross. The prosecution didn't waste time. They didn't attack Russell personally. Instead, they walked straight to the foundation of her testimony and started shaking it brick by brick. First, they pointed out what she was not. Dr. Russell, for all her credentials, was not a veterinary expert, not a forensic ontologist. I might have already said that word wrong. And not someone who had conducted an autopsy in this case. She had never examined John O'Keefe's body. Her conclusions were built entirely on a photo. Medical records, autopsy images, and secondhand reports. Then the prosecution asked the obvious question, where's the dog? If the dog was responsible for these injuries, where is the physical proof? There's no dog DNA. There's no saliva, no hair, no canine tissue traces on the body. Nothing recovered from O'Keefe's clothing, wounds, or even the scene that could link the injury to an animal. No blood-stained dog bed, no bites matched to a particular jaw spread, just interpretation, visual theory that's already been debunked. Nothing really verifiable. That was the difference, data versus possibility. The prosecution emphasized that the actual cause of death, as certified by the chief medical examiner, was blunt force trauma consistent with being hit by a car, not a dog nipping your arm. And what a light nip would that would be from the jawless dog. A forensic conclusion drawn not from photographs, but from hands-on, first-hand examination of the body. Internal injuries, tissue damage, contusions, a physical chain of evidence that had already been reviewed by medical experts during earlier phases of the trial. Russell's analysis, by contrast, couldn't contradict the ME's findings directly. It could only suggest an alternative, and even then, that suggestion lacked anything physical to back it up. Her conclusions weren't drawn from a fresh autopsy or from a bite mark swab. They were drawn from viewing pictures and comparing them to injuries she'd seen before. The jury sat quietly through the cross, but the tone was different. There was no shouting, no personal accusations, just steady, methodical questioning that made it clear this wasn't about discrediting Dr. Russell as a person. It was about showing the limitations of her input and how much she hadn't done. One key moment came when prosecutors asked about the absence of any trauma to the lower half of O'Keefe's body. Russell had claimed that the lack of leg injuries undermined the car strike theory, suggesting that a car would have impacted the legs first. The prosecution countered by pointing to the totality of the injuries, head trauma, internal bleeding, skull fractures, injuries that, according to the medical examiner, still fit the pattern of being knocked over by a reversing vehicle and then falling onto frozen ground. Russell stuck to her point, though. She said the distribution of injuries and the tearing observed on the arms didn't look like road rash or bumper impact. She reiterated that they looked more like something inflicted by teeth, but again, without any physical or biological evidence to support that, just a hair sample. Saliva and a matching bite radius. None of that existed. There was no hair. There's no saliva. There's no bite radius. In fact, it looks like I said before, the dog would have had to have no jaw. So without any of that, it became a theory that didn't have a big anchor to it. By the time court adjourned, Russell was still on the stand. The prosecution hadn't finished, but the cracks in the foundation had already been revealed. Her testimony may have added layers to the defense's alternative theory, but it didn't reinforce it. Not in any sort of forensic sense, not in a scientific one, that's for sure. And without hard evidence, the dog bite narrative landed more like a distraction than a defense. Something that sounded like an alternative, but felt like an out. Whether the jury sees it that way, that's still up for grabs. What's clear is that the science, at least so far, hasn't saved Karen Reed. And it hasn't changed the one question that still hangs in the room. What happened outside that house, and why is no one taking responsibility? Maybe we'll get more answers soon.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Karen Reed.
I picture this one. You're a defense attorney facing a mountain of evidence that your client killed her boyfriend. And your best strategy is to convince a jury that there's a massive conspiracy involving multiple law enforcement officers and a dog and other first responders and crime labs. And yeah, that's essentially what happened in a Massachusetts courtroom this week. And while the defense presented their witnesses, the fundamental evidence against Karen Reed remains unchanged. Welcome back. Be sure to press subscribe and let us know what you think about the case and what's going on in the comment section wherever you are viewing us on YouTube or X. Press subscribe, and wherever you're listening to us on the podcast platform, please hit subscribe there right now before you forget so you don't miss out on any of our coverage on this or the many cases we cover for you here at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. My name's Tony Bruschi. Thanks for hanging out and I don't know what to call this anymore. Absorbing the information, enduring the information. I think it's like morbid curiosity at this point in the Karen Reed trial of what is going on in it. So, Wednesday, June 4th, it brought some interesting testimony to Karen Reed's retrial that the defense hopes will create reasonable doubt. But when you examine what actually happened, we saw witnesses' testimony that raises as many questions about the witnesses themselves as it does about the prosecution's case. The whole thing got cut short when Judge Beverly Cannone suspended proceedings due to extreme heat, canceling Thursday's session entirely. Yes, at this day and age, they're canceling. I wonder if they cancel like all of court in Massachusetts, like all summer, like from here on out. Is it just we're not coming back till October or August or something? I don't know. For those just tuning in, Karen Reed is accused of killing her boyfriend, Boston police officer John O'Keefe, by striking him with her SUV outside fellow officer Brian Elbert's house in Canton, Massachusetts on January 29th, 2022. The prosecution alleges that she was intoxicated, struck O'Keefe after dropping him off, and left him to die in a blizzard. The defense claims O'Keefe was beaten to death inside the Elbert home and that Reed is being framed by corrupt law enforcement officers. Wednesday's star witness was Brian Lucky Loughran, a Canton Department of Public Works snowplow driver whose truck, Franken truck, was equipped with extremely bright lights. Lucky testified that during his 2:45 a.m. pass down Fairview Road, he saw nothing where O'Keefe's body was later discovered. He also spotted a Ford Edge SUV parked in front of the Elbert house at 3:30 a.m., which he said was unusual since the Elberts typically didn't park vehicles on the street. Now, the defense is treating this testimony as a smoking gun. That destroys the prosecution's timeline. They argue that if O'Keefe was allegedly struck at 12:45 a.m. and he lay there until 6 a.m., Lucky should have seen the body. But there are several important factors to consider here. First, this was during an active blizzard with heavy snow falling continuously. And by 2:45, yeah, the body laying in accumulating snow, especially one positioned in a way that might not be immediately obvious to a driver focused on plowing operations, could reasonably be missed. Snow removal operators are concentrating on road conditions and snow removal, not conducting forensic examinations of every yard that they pass. Second, and this is crucial, Special Prosecutor Hank Brennan exposed significant issues with Lucky's testimony during cross-examination. Brennan highlighted multiple inconsistencies between Lucky's current account and his previous statements to investigators. Lucky couldn't maintain a consistent timeline about when he admitted to returning to the area, first saying it was 5:30 a.m., then claiming 6:15 a.m. More problematically, when Brennan pressed Lucky about his exposure to media coverage of the case. Lucky admitted he has been following it extensively. "With all due respect, sir, I don't live under a rock. It's all over social media and the news. You can't avoid it," he testified. This admission is significant because it means Lucky's testimony isn't the uncontaminated eyewitness account the defense wants the jury to believe. He's been exposed to theories, speculation, and detailed coverage of the case and taking selfies with a lot of people as well over the last 3 years. The Ford Edge that Lucky noticed at 3:30 a.m. is interesting, but hardly the conspiracy evidence the defense suggests. During social gatherings, especially ones involving alcohol, it's common for vehicles to be parked in unusual locations when driveways fill up or when people are arranging rides. The defense wants this suggested mysterious nighttime activity, or wants to suggest this mysterious nighttime activity, but it could be simply someone who stayed later than others or needed to retrieve something from their car, or who knows. Or it could have been on a completely different street. If you watch Lucky, you get what I'm talking about. Lucky also didn't notice the giant red dumpsters that were in all of the driveways. Brennan pointed that out also on Cross. So kind of big things to, you know, not remember. The other key witness was Katrina, I'm going to screw up her name, Katrina is what we're calling her, and I do apologize for the name. A Canton pharmacist who was at the Waterfall Bar and Grill that evening. Katrina testified about observing what she described as a loving interaction between Reed and O'Keefe, including a forehead kiss that struck her as sweet. She also described John O'Keefe as being very happy about his daughter's acceptance to private school. However, Katrina's testimony also confirmed that both Reed and O'Keefe had been drinking heavily that night. Regardless of whether their mood was celebratory alcohol consumption, it's kind of central to the prosecution's case about impaired judgment and reaction time. Additionally, Katrina witnessed enough tension and drama to remember specific details 3 years later, including O'Keefe shouting something towards a group containing the Elberts and Brian Higgins, with Chris Elbert having to physically restrain Higgins, allegedly. Katrina also testified about Jennifer McCabe's insistence that Reed came with her, describing McCabe as saying, "You're coming with me, you're coming with me." Well, Reed responded with confusion. The defense presents this as evidence of manipulation, but it could equally represent someone trying to help an intoxicated person, you know, make it, you know, safe decisions about transportation and where to go next, you know, like that. Not a weird conspiracy that they're planning before anything even happens. Anyway, the defense showed surveillance footage capturing the tension between O'Keefe and the others, but this actually raises questions that don't necessarily help their case. If there was an underlying conflict, it supports the prosecution's narrative that the evening involved alcohol-fueled tensions that could lead to poor decisions and tragic consequences. What's important to understand is that none of Wednesday's testimony addresses the core physical evidence in the case. Karen Reed's SUV sustained damage consistent with striking a person. John O'Keefe's injuries were consistent with being struck by a vehicle. Reed made statements suggesting she might have hit something with her car. Her behavior the next morning, returning to the scene, is consistent with someone who suspected they might have caused an accident while intoxicated. Her own words. The defense's conspiracy theory requires believing that multiple law enforcement officers spontaneously decided to murder John O'Keefe and frame Karen Reed. Again, this would necessitate split-second coordination among numerous people, perfect execution of a complex plan, and absolute secrecy maintained by everyone involved for over 3 years despite intense scrutiny. When you lay it out logistically, the implausibility becomes apparent. Consider what the defense is asking the jury to accept. Brian Elbert and others allegedly killed O'Keefe inside the house, then moved his body outside, positioned it to simulate a car accident, coordinate their stories perfectly, anticipate that Reed would return the next morning and somehow manipulate all subsequent investigations. Every person at the party would need to be complicit, and every investigator afterward would need to be either incompetent or corrupt. Compare that to the prosecution's straightforward explanation. An intoxicated couple had tensions after a night of heavy drinking. Reed dropped O'Keefe off, but due to impairment or anger or both, struck him with her vehicle. Recognizing what happened, she left the scene. The next morning, consumed by guilt and worry, she returned to look for him. Which one is more logical? This explanation aligns with the physical evidence, doesn't require elaborate conspiracies, and matches patterns of behavior seen in similar cases involving alcohol-related incidents. It's tragic, but it's believable, and it's supported by multiple forms of evidence. Not, he kissed her on the forehead, and the prosecution's approach throughout the case has been methodical and evidence-focused. Rather than getting distracted by conspiracy, they've consistently returned to the physical facts and Karen Reed's own statements and actions. Brennan's cross-examination of Lucky Lauren demonstrated this approach, systematic addressing the witnesses' inconsistencies and potential biases from media exposure. What we're witnessing is a defense team employing a common strategy in cases with strong evidence against their client. Create enough confusion and alternative theories that some jurors might doubt the prosecution's case. They're hoping that if they can raise questions about minor details, the jury might overlook the substantial evidence pointing to Reed's guilt. The defense expanded their case significantly for this retrial from 2 days in the first trial to potentially 2 weeks now. However, more witnesses don't necessarily mean a stronger case, especially when those witnesses have credibility issues or when their testimony doesn't actually contradict the central evidence. Judge Cannone noted that the trial remains ahead of schedule, despite the heat-related suspension, suggesting that proceedings are moving efficiently. The heat wave suspension gives both sides time to prepare, but it doesn't change the fundamental dynamics of the case. As the trial prepares to resume Friday, hopefully, the prosecution maintains several advantages. They have physical evidence that the defense cannot explain away. They have Reed's own statements and behaviors that support their narrative. They've demonstrated that defense witnesses have potential credibility problems and that their testimony doesn't undermine the core case. Karen Reed faces second-degree murder, manslaughter, while operating under the influence and leaving the scene charges. First trial ended in a hung jury, indicating that some jurors found the conspiracy theories pervasive while others focused on the evidence. This retrial gives the prosecution an opportunity to refine their presentation and address the defense's theories more directly. The challenge for any jury in a high-profile case like this is separating social media narratives and public opinion from courtroom evidence. The defense has been effective at generating sympathy for Reed and suspicion about law enforcement through media coverage, but courtroom decisions must be based on evidence presented under oath and subject to cross-examination. Looking ahead, the prosecution will likely continue their methodical approach, addressing each defense theory with facts and evidence. They'll work to demonstrate that while the defense can create confusion about peripheral details, they can't provide credible explanations for the central evidence. Defense? Well, they face a challenge of presenting enough witnesses and theories to maintain their conspiracy narrative without having those witnesses undermine their case through inconsistencies or credibility problems. Lucky's admission of extensive media exposure illustrates that risk. Where's it going to go? Well, only time will tell. What do you think about how the case went today. Tell me in the comments section. I know it was only a half day, but I'm curious as to your thoughts on those two witnesses. It'd be nice to have a little break, a little breather for a day. Press subscribe wherever you're listening to this or watching this so you don't miss any of our coverage. And again, please let us know in the comments what your thoughts are on the case. I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Ryan Seacrest here. When you have a busy schedule, it's important to maximize your downtime. One of the best ways to do that is by going to ChumbaCasino.com. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino games like spin slots, bingo, and solitaire that you can play for free for a chance to redeem some serious prizes. So hop on to ChumbaCasino.com now and live the Chumba life. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Ryan Seacrest here. When you have a busy schedule, it's important to maximize your downtime. One of the best ways to do that is by going to ChumbaCasino.com. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino games like spin slots, bingo, and solitaire that you can play for free for a chance to redeem some serious prizes. So hop on to ChumbaCasino.com now and live the Chumba life. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.